There's too much at stake here. What happens to me is of no particular consequence. Whether the rule of law and our democracy survive is of enormous consequence. And I'm going to do whatever I can to try to make sure that that happens.
Welcome to Shield of the Republic, a podcast sponsored by the Bulwark and the Miller Center of Public Affairs at the University of Virginia. I'm Eric Edelman, counselor at the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments, non-resident fellow at the Miller Center, and I'm joined by my partner in all things strategery, Elliot Cohen, professor of emeritus of strategy at the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies and a contributing writer to The Atlantic. Elliot, now, this is our next to last podcast on the Bulwark.
Right.
After which, our listeners and viewers who want to continue to hear us out on these subjects will have to turn to shieldoftherepublic.com, which will take them to our new independent Substack at ShieldPod at both Substack, Instagram, and Twitter. How are you doing?
I'm doing fine. I'm actually very excited by this change because I think we should remind our listeners that in addition to the free weekly podcast, we're going to have a paid subscription where for a very, very modest amount of money, you'll get access to a lot more material. That'll include things like book reviews, hot takes on breaking events, gift articles that the two of us have written, and who knows, maybe at some point in the future, merch. We have a wonderful guest waiting for us, and there's so much to cover that, with your permission, I'm just going to jump right into the jackasseries of the week. Now, my original intention, Eric, was, as you know, I'm trying to get beyond simple outrage at the Trump administration, but they won't let me. But I will start with the thing that I was going to lead with, and then I will revert to the Trump administration. The thing I was going to lead with was a scandal which has really only been covered in the Australian media, which the Australian Prime Minister made what can only be described as an extremely crude set of gestures in reference to the Japanese Prime Minister. I'm not going to go any further than that. If you want to...
Please don't. I'm aware of what he said, but...
It was gross and disgusting. So yeah. Not only was it a boorish
high school humor,
if that, which shows what kind of leader he is. He's not a very serious guy. There's a larger point here, which is the administration is very good on beating up on our European allies, and it's had some useful effects, including building defense spending. They haven't done that to the Australians. And dearly though I love Australia, and I've been there frequently, as you know, and have many dear Australian friends, they are actually falling way behind. Their defense spending is going to be about 2% of GDP. We are engaged in something called AUKUS, which is this Australia-US-UK relationship, mainly about building submarines, about all this other stuff. These are submarines which won't show up for years and years to come. It's now become an excuse for the Australian government not to spend on lots of other things that are really desperately needed. They're being profoundly unserious. So I would just urge the Trump administration, if you want to get back into our good graces, to if you want to find an ally to beat up on the Australians. Their government deserves it, although the population does not. So I was going to stop there, but I can't because there's just so much stuff that you and I have been talking about. The one that I'm going to mention, and this literally just broke, Vice President J.D. Vance is on Fox News, and he's being uncharacteristically, perhaps, pressed by the Fox News reporter on what exactly are we trying to achieve in Iran. He says, well, the first objective is to ensure is keeping oil and gas cheap for all Americans wherever they may be. And that's the first objective, and preventing Iran from getting nuclear weapons is second. Now, this is a war which has driven gas prices up, and which in some ways could only have driven gas and oil prices up. The nuclear issue is a serious issue. For J.D. Vance to say that is, I mean, I assume it's just political pandering, but it's a level of, well, I'll just call it jackassery, which even for this administration And even by the standards of Secretary of Defense Pete Hegseth, our favorite whipping boy, really sets some kind of new bar for jackassery. What about you?
Hard to argue with that. And I'm pretty sure all of our mutual Australian friends would probably agree with you about Prime Minister Albanese and his unfortunate attempt at humor. Well, I have two, jackasseries to offer. One is connected with our guest, Frank Kendall, former Secretary of the Air Force, who had his security clearance stripped by the Department of Defense because he was interviewed by the New York Times about the president's use of Air Force One, a topic to which you and I will return in a minute, and noted that there can't have been enough time nor enough money expended on updating the Qatari aircraft to the safety standards we normally use for presidential aircraft. This was an issue, you know, when the whole gift idea came up. It's clear from reading, you know, again, the Maggie Haberman, Jonathan Swan book, that the president just was seduced with all of the, you know, the potentate level creature comforts on the Qatari aircraft. But in order to, sort of try and distract people's attention to strip, a distinguished public servant, you know, like Frank Kendall, who, as we will discuss later in the show, is making a great contribution to the debate over future warfare, just total jackassery. The other jackassery is, you know, in the spirit of King Canute, the president has now ordained that henceforth the U.S. most modern aircraft carriers, the Ford class, will not have electromagnetic catapults. We're going to strip those out, which is going to cost untold billions of dollars, and replace them with the old steam catapults, for which these new vessels are not piped and plumbed. Meaning that even though we've got sailors jumping off the Abraham Lincoln because it's been deployed for 9 months and they're having trouble resupplying it, and there's terrible morale on the ship, and we have these long deployments now, we're going to completely screw up the whole carrier replacement schedule on a presidential whim. And I can't think of anything more emblematic of the idiocy of this administration's approach to defense.
But at least they're replacing a more advanced, efficient, and less technology, which requires considerably less manpower to operate, with an older, inefficient, unnecessary system. I mean, the arrogance and the ignorance are really something.
Well, let's turn to the president on Air Force One.
Let me open with something which I know you do not believe. You actually have a very serious critique of that. I think I thought, frankly, a lot of the press coverage of this business of the, you know, president goes in one door, he goes out a catering truck, goes onto another airplane. That's silly. I mean, you know, the Secret Service will do whatever the Secret Service needs to do to keep the president safe. If they think that the platform is at risk, well, then by all means, you know, do those kinds of shenanigans. Yes, maybe Secretary Rubio should feel a little bit miffed that
a tethered goat.
That he was a tethered goat. But that's between him and the president. And I thought the journalists kind of falling all over themselves to congratulate themselves about how they figured this out. That's just silly. But there is something serious, and that would be.
Well, the problem here is at the outset, which is precisely because this aircraft has not been fully modernized and fully updated with the suite of capabilities that we normally associate with protecting the president on a special air missions aircraft. The idea that he should have taken this to the NATO summit, which is adjacent to a war zone, was totally irresponsible to begin with. And it was, again, a presidential whim. This was driven totally by presidential whim. And then, of course, the intelligence that there was a threat against the aircraft, however seriously you take that threat. I mean, the Secret Service is more inclined to take some of these threats seriously than the intelligence community might be for all sorts of reasons, not the least of which they don't want to take a chance that it could be right and that they lose a president because they didn't pay attention to it. So given their, you know, their history and given the fact that there've been three attempts on the current president's life, and an ongoing threat. So the idea that he did this to begin with is just the worst kind of irresponsibility.
Yeah, completely agree with that. As long as we're Iran
put everybody at risk.
Yeah, I agree.
Put everybody on that.
On Iran, as long as we're Iran war adjacent, maybe let's talk briefly about that. One thing is there have been some personnel shifts at the top of the Iranian government. I had just two observations about it. First, none of the guys getting ahead are nice guys. So the new head of the Supreme National Security Council was directly implicated in the Amia massacre. This was an attack on a Jewish community center some years ago, which killed hundreds of, you know, it killed hundreds of Jews, which made them happy, but was not an attack even on an Israeli target. It was just an attack on a Jewish target. The second thing, as I was following some of the reporting on all this, that struck me is the age of these people. There are a couple in their late 60s. Almost all of them are now in their early 70s. And I think that is a significant thing in a couple of ways. One, it tells you that they have not been able to manage any kind of generational leadership transition. That's a problem that authoritarian governments, I think, often have. But it also means that they're going to be subject to all the vicissitudes that aging people are, which is a certain kind of rigidity, you know, being locked in the past, more certainty that you're right, willingness to disregard discrepant information, concern, you know, about doing the big thing that'll ensure your place in history, none of which augurs well, I think.
Yeah, I don't disagree with that. I mean, it does seem here that Mujtaba Khamenei, the supreme leader, is to some degree reasserting after a spate of stories about his health and also that decisions are being made without reference to him, is reasserting some of his authority here. And it's taking the form of, as you say, a lot of kind of old people that he knew when he was younger and in the IRGC during the Iran-Iraq war. I mean, the striking thing to me is how many of these folk are people who essentially cut their teeth during that war in the 1980s. And so, yeah, I agree that we're, you know, getting a group of characters who are not inclined, you know, to look to diplomacy to secure their ends. And they're also being put not just in charge of, I mean, there's some organizational changes to try and create a more unified IRGC, Artesh, regular military, and the IRGC together to fight in a more seamless way. But also there, some of these folk are being put in charge of the internal security apparatus, the besiege. So there's that.
I guess just one other or two other things. One, they have been making more noise than usual about doing things externally, including with the besiege, which I don't know quite how that would work since these are mainly teenage kids. The other thing is you occasionally now see stories about how much oil is getting out of the Strait of Hormuz. And there clearly is oil coming out. Moving at night close to the Omani shore. I mean, I'm sure there's a story here, and I'm sure that we're involved in it. It does seem to me that between the various pipelines I guess there's one main pipeline that now exists. Well, there are two pipelines, one a UAE to Oman, but also a Saudi pipeline, that there's more oil getting out than one might think. I mean, there have been all these predictions of doom and disaster because oil supplies would be cut off. That clearly hasn't quite happened. That's the good news. On the other, the bad news is the Houthis have gotten much more active in trying to close the strait, the Bab el-Mandeb, which, you know, would be a very serious problem for oil that transits by pipeline across Saudi Arabia. So all this worth paying attention to.
Yeah, I mean, just a couple of comments on that. One, on the so, yes, the pipelines are both maxed out now. Both the Saudis and the Emiratis have maxed out the pipelines. That doesn't come close, though, to replacing the 20 million barrels a day that were coming out of the Gulf by sea. Second, there are more pipelines planned for the future. But contrary to Secretary Scott Bessent's view that, you know, the Strait of Hormuz is going to be, you know, unimportant in 2 years, which is, by the way, a very long time for, you know, the suffering American consumer. Number one, the Iranians will undoubtedly target these pipelines.
Yeah, sure.
And they're very, you know, very susceptible to attack by, you know, explosive drones. That will raise the insurance rates. These are hugely capital intensive projects that cost enormous amounts of money. To do so, you know, it may not come online as quickly as people think. I'm a little suspect about the numbers that Secretary of Energy Wright has used about how many millions of barrels of oil have come out. There are commercial outfits that watch ships coming out of the Gulf that suggest it's far less than he has said. So I think there's a lot of uncertainty about all of this, and we'll have to see where it all goes.
Yeah, just one. I think one other aspect of this, because it is a complicated problem, and it's clearly having an effect. There's also increased oil production in other places, including the United States,
sure,
which has taken up some of the slack.
Guyana, yeah. Other places around the world.
Yeah. And it's not all completely fungible, and it depends where the refineries are and all that. But I think, I guess I would have predicted that, you know, this war has now been going on for some time. I would have expected much more consequential price rises than the ones we've seen so far, which doesn't mean that it may not happen, you know, over the next year or so.
Well, just final point on this, and then I know you want to turn to some of the diplomatic sides of this. One is that, oil is not the only commodity here that's involved. I mean, oil, our own holdings in the Strategic Petroleum Reserve are now at the lowest level they've been since we built the thing in the early 1980s. The administration just had a major drawdown because they're trying to keep the price below $4 a gallon in the United States for political reasons. They're going to have trouble as time goes on, you know, going much lower because we're getting to really low levels in the SPRO. Second is that it's not just about oil. I mean, there's also LNG and there are all these other things that come out of the Gulf, ammonia, urea, sulfur, helium, all of these things, which are important for the manufacture of microchips, fertilizer, other key elements of the either agricultural or the industrial economy. And those things are not, you know, there's no pipeline workaround for that. You know, those traveling over land is not as cost effective as going, you know, by sea. So this is a more complicated and difficult story than I think a lot of people would have you believe.
I agree with that. So one related diplomatic question that I wanted to ask you about is there was an agreement that was signed between Saudi Arabia, Turkey, and Pakistan. It's not quite an alliance. Nobody's quite sure what exactly it means. Although, look, there are connections already between these countries. There've long been, the Pakistani-Saudi connection, for example, has been very close. And a lot of people have speculated with some reason that there's a nuclear connection there. The thing that strikes me about this isn't good news for Israel, and it's not good news for Iran either. And I kind of doubt that it's good news for us. So three very different countries for whom it's not good news.
And I agree with all of that, although I think it'll be interesting to see how much there is there.
That's always the question.
What I mean by that is, first of all, this trilateral pact, between Turkey, Pakistan, and the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia builds on an earlier Pakistani Saudi bilateral pact. Allegedly, according to Turkish Foreign Minister Hakan Fidan, it entails a Article 5-like mutual security guarantee that an attack on one is an attack on all. However, when Saudi Arabia was attacked a few weeks ago by Iran, by drones attacking Saudi energy infrastructure, Pakistan did not come to the kingdom's defense. And when the Houthis this past week attacked Saudi infrastructure, Turkey and Pakistan did not come to Saudi's defense. So how much there is an open question. I think, though, when you start thinking about Turkey's very well-developed defense industry, which, of course, is very active in the UAV market. They're building an intercontinental ballistic missile. They've built shorter-range missiles. They build tracked and wheeled vehicles. Put that together with Saudi money and Pakistan's nuclear know-how, there could be a whole lot of, untoward, consequences that come from all that. They are pitching it as, we're doing what the Americans asked us to do. We're going to be more self-reliant and, we're going to be contributing more to our own defense so the Americans don't have to contribute so much to our mutual defense. Again, we'll see how much of that is real. But I think your basic initial point, Elliot, is right, which is there's at one level, this is a Sunni bloc against a Shia revisionist power in the region. But if you listen to, again, what Foreign Minister Hakan Fidan said, as well as some comments others have made, the discussions about this trilateral pact have gone back 2.5 years. So to the period almost immediately after October 7th, 2023. And so this is not just directed at Iran. This is also clearly directed at Israel and the fears that these three powers have of, to put it in Thucydidean terms, Israel's rising power. And it's directed at us because of the belief that I think the Saudis certainly have, but also the Turks and the Pakistanis, is we're not that reliable a security guarantor anymore. And I think some of that's driven by the most recent developments in the negotiations and the comments that have been reportedly attributed to the president and numerous press accounts that he wants to walk away from all this. Just doesn't, which is not, kind of reassuring to people who have plighted their troth with us in the past and expected us to be the guarantors of their security.
Yeah, and of course, like all alliances or quasi-alliances, everybody has different interests. And I think for the Pakistanis, it's Saudi money. The Pakistani hostility to Israel is extraordinarily profound. I mean, the foreign minister was saying really sort of crazy annihilationist stuff. People have just gotten used to that. I think the Saudi interest actually is in a certain way, getting us back in there by saying, well, we have other options. I mean, I think we probably are a preferred partner. And I think for Turkey, this is part of Erdogan's Ottomanist desire for Turkey to be a great regional power. So the motivations are different. That may not matter right now. It may matter down the road, but it's certainly a pretty significant development, I'd say.
Let's turn to Ukraine. My fear here, and I'll be interested in your view of this, we've got pretty much on the front line stasis on the battlefield. The Ukrainians have, figured out pretty much how to, there's some back and forth over who controls, Konstantinivka, and there have been these sort of meme wars about between Ukraine and Russia about who's actually, controlled the center of the city and putting flags up and that kind of stuff. But we're talking about micro advances. I think the our friends at the Institute for the Study of War kind of looked at the net of, you know, land movement. This figure may not be exact, but it's pretty close. They've calculated that the Russians in the first 7 months of this year have essentially gained 87 square kilometers, which is not much, but that the losses now are, you know, running at the 10 to 12,000 a month rate. There are some allied intelligence agencies that are now saying the Russians have suffered 500,000 killed and, you know, north of 1.3 million total casualties, which are just kind of mind-numbing, astonishing numbers. The Russians have been engaged in this really brutal missile and drone assault on Ukraine, which is short of interceptors and therefore having much less success in intercepting Russian missiles. But the Russians themselves have constraints. So the Russians can only produce about, according to Ukrainian estimates, about 70 ballistic missiles a month. They use something like 195 in July, which is probably one reason why they've imported, I think we mentioned it last week, this Korean ballistic missile battalion. And I've seen now reports that at least one Korean ballistic missile has been identified as having been fired at Ukraine. My fear, and tell me if I'm wrong here, is that Putin still believes he can win. He thinks that he's got a comparative advantage now because Ukraine is short interceptors, so he can pretty much fire ballistic missiles and drones at will. Last year in September, October, they launched a brutal campaign aimed at energy targets in Ukraine to try and break the will of the Ukrainian people. And I think he's going to do it again. And he's tried to sort of sweeten the pot for President Trump and try and get President Trump back on side by releasing this fellow who was being held as a, you know, unfairly charged American. And knowing that Trump, who, you know, whose formative experiences in life were in the 1980s during the Iran hostage crisis, has been enormously sensitive to, you know, Americans detained abroad and delighted to bring them back and claim credit for it.
So a couple of thoughts. First, let me just begin saying something about the casualties that you were talking about. What you're talking about is a war in which the Russians may be taking maybe two wounded for every killed. By comparison, a modern military like us or the Israelis, it's more like one killed for eight or even 10 wounded. Now, that's partly a result of the kind of war they're fighting with this very dense drone environment, which makes it harder to evacuate people. But I think it's also the Russian military is a much more primitive military when it comes to anything that has to do with soldier survivability or care. And we've talked about this before. This also will ripple back as these broken men come back into Russia with a lot of anger and frequently with weapons. Secondly, I think to your point, I think actually we're entering a pretty dangerous time where the Russians are hoping for right-wing governments to begin popping up in Europe over elections. And I think I can imagine them thinking, I believe they would be wrong, but I can imagine Putin thinking that this is the right moment to do something to Estonia or Lithuania or Latvia. Now, in practice, I think actually the actual result would be just the reverse of what he wanted. But this is a guy who does not understand his opponents in the same way that we didn't particularly understand him. To your last point about the missile war, here's my basic thought. I talk about this in my forthcoming book, which will be out October 20th, and we'll be hopefully be talking about it at some point. You know, in some ways, I think the wars that we may begin to see, even though we're in an era of precision weapons, could revert to what warfare was like in the mid to late 19th century and the first half of the 20th century. That is to say, it's about breaking societal will. I mean, there will come a point, I think, where if the Ukrainians are really suffering, they will say, okay, do you want to see what it's like to have hundreds of drones and ballistic missiles raining down indiscriminately on your capital city? We'll show you what that's like. And honestly, who can blame them? I mean, it's not a good thing. It's a very bad thing. But, you know, you just look at what the dynamic was in World War II, where you began with, in theory, the law of war banned the bombing of cities. And, you know, people were initially a little bit hesitant about doing it, not very, the Germans in particular. But, I mean, there was a proposal, I think, at the very beginning of World War II to mine the Rhine with floating mines. The British were going to drop these mines. And people said, whoa, 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 whoa. You know, that could damage private property. We can't have that. And I think those kinds of compunctions, you know, clearly went away to the point that you get Hamburg and Dresden and all the rest. So unfortunately, I think this is a path we're likely to see not only the Ukrainians go down, but a lot of other countries as well, because it, you know, at a certain level, as war, the intensity of war escalates, it's about cracking societal will. And now the Ukrainians have the industrial capability to deliver some of that.
Yeah. And, you know, one of my fears here is that, well, not a fear, but it's, you know, I think an observation that because the Ukrainians are suffering from a shortage of missile defense interceptors, the only places, I mean, we've got a huge problem on our hands. So they're not, and the administration stops supplying the Ukrainians with them. The only sources in Europe that I'm aware of that haven't already been tapped are essentially the Spaniards and the Greeks. And for a lot of political reasons, I don't think either one of those countries is likely to pony up, which leaves the Ukrainians with another option, which plays into what you were just saying, which is if you can't have a defense against ballistic missile attacks, your next best option is to develop the offensive capability to make your adversary feel the same pain. And so you see the Ukrainians reports that the Ukrainians are accelerating production of their FP7, FP9 ballistic missiles that have shorter and then longer range. And you can imagine, you know, if as you and I are just, you know, suggesting that they're subject to this kind of attack, they will do this not on the same scale as the Russians. They won't be able to do it, but they'll be able to, you know, pick some crucial locations like Moscow and St. Petersburg, maybe a couple of other Russian cities, to really bring the war home to the Russian population as well. And, you know, there are all sorts of, you know, knock-on effects potentially from all of that.
Well, I think that's right. Listen, we have our guest waiting for us, but I thought maybe we can – one final issue, which the two of us, I think, wanted to discuss a little bit. We had a couple of interesting elections in Michigan and Wisconsin. The Michigan one ended up the way people thought it did, but it was a squeaker. In Wisconsin, Ms. Hong did not do well. She lost to a moderate Democrat. What do we make of all this?
Well, I'm very fond of citing the late political scientist V.O. Key, who was one of the pioneers of cephalogy, the study of voting and voters. And he always used to say that, you know, he had a reverence for the sober second thought of the American electorate. And so I think what you're seeing here is kind of normie Democrats who care, by and large, by the way, African Americans.
And working class.
And working class in both states, basically saying what really matters is beating the Republicans because we want to push back against Trump, and nominating people who want to ban Thanksgiving and empty the prisons and open borders and all the rest of this. Probably not, you know, a recipe for success. Both you and I have read a Substack by Claire Berlinski about how this is the greatest gift to the Republicans imaginable, and why the chairman of the DSA is the most dangerous person in America. And I think that what you're seeing is a healthy reaction against all that. So that's good.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think the one other angle, which I think is really interesting, is that the polls were so widely off. They were off in Wisconsin, where there was a lot of sort of changes at the end of that campaign. But in Michigan, they were widely off too. I mean, Abdul al-Sayed was supposed to romp home with a margin of, I don't know, 10-12%. And instead, it was a squeaker. And one of the explanations I've seen is you're now beginning to get these problems with who responds to requests to participate in a poll, and that it has tended to be disproportionately the kinds of people who are going to vote for people like Hong and al-Sayed.
Yeah, there's also the fact that primary elections are notoriously more difficult to poll because you have less longitudinal series data to compare and baseline your understanding of who's going to turn out. But the thing that's like crazy is that, you know, the turnout in the Democratic primary in Wisconsin was insanely high. I mean, it was a huge, huge turnout. And that, I think, actually is important, because what that tells you is Democratic voters are really very heavily motivated to, you know, come out and vote and show their opposition to, you know, the Trump administration. And I think you're going to see that in November, and the Republicans are going to try and use the DSA scarecrow to, you know, to drive their voters out. Whether they'll, you know, historically, without Donald Trump on the ballot, they haven't been able to do that.
Yeah, agreed.
Well, let's turn to our guest. This is just a reminder that in a few weeks, we will be going independent. We look forward to continuing to engage with our many listeners and viewers. You'll be able to reach us at shieldoftherepublic.com or at Substack at ShieldPod, on YouTube at ShieldPod, or on Twitter and Instagram at ShieldPod. Well, now let us turn to our guest, Frank Kendall, who is former Secretary of the Air Force, former Undersecretary of Defense for Acquisition, a former Army officer, and the author of this book, Lethal Autonomy, The Future of Warfare, Whether We Like It or Not. And Frank, welcome to Shield of the Republic. It's great to have you.
Eric, Ellie, it's good to be with you too. Great to see both of you guys.
So let me start off, if I might, since I have the dubious distinction of having chaired two commissions that the Congress set up to review the Department of Defense's National Defense Strategy in 2018, where I co-chaired with Gary Ruffhead, former CNO, and in 2024, where I co-chaired with former Representative Jane Harman. And one of the things we, in both of those reports, complained about was, first, the decline of analytic capability inside the Department of Defense, along with the decline of our superpower rival, the ability to actually look at what modern warfare against a peer would look like kind of went away. And then the fact that we had both of these strategies that had all of these, we're going to do this, we're going to do that, with no discussion whatsoever of what operational concepts we would actually put into play to be able to, hopefully, first of all, by exercising and demonstrating them, deter our adversaries, but if deterrence fails, actually defeat them. And Frank, your book really takes, you know, all of this on. And first of all, thank you for what you did as Secretary of the Air Force to restore some analytic capability to the department. Well, you know, really overdue. But talk, if you would, for a second about the operational concepts that you sketch out here for how the Department of Defense can integrate autonomy, which we've seen displayed on the battlefield in both the war with Iran and the Ukrainian war as well, and AI into the future force. You do a great job of talking in the book about the role that, and you played a part in this, that assault breaker, follow-on forces attack, air-land battle played in the 1980s in defeating the Soviet Union, winning the Cold War. And clearly your aspiration is to provide us with something akin to that in this book. And as you say, modestly in the book, you don't have all the answers, but you certainly sketch out how we should think about it. So if you would just talk about that for a bit.
Sure. My life has been about the intersection of technology and its application to military, forces in some form or another. I've served as an operator, as well as in the research and development side of things. And I've worked with all the services. So I have a pretty unusual and broad background in what works and what doesn't work in a military context from the point of view of technology. And a very common error is to take an interesting new technology and think you can just stick it into a force and use it. You've got to think through all the implications of the technology. You've got to think about how you're going to use it operationally, how it fits into a broader operational context. And you've got to think about how you organize your forces to utilize the technology. And I try to touch on all of those things in the book. And Eric, as you indicated, this should all have an analytical basis. Our intuition is good. More experienced we are, the more knowledge we have, but it's not enough. And you've really got to work the numbers to understand what will work effectively and how to optimize it. So I couldn't do all that in the book, but I could bring a lot of that experience to bear to lay out what I thought was as complete a picture as possible of what our future might look like in the joint domain and in all the various military domains. Your point about the loss of analytic capability is spot on. I came back to government in 2010 after being gone for 15 years, and I was astonished at how people were making decisions about major weapon systems and their requirements from the seat of their pants, purely from intuition. More is better generally, but that's not enough. You've got to be a lot more precise than that because everything's a trade-off. So, in terms of operational context, if there's one way to think about, in many domains at least, space might be an exception, and cyber certainly is, how you organize a force around autonomous platforms. The thing I did in the book that I haven't seen anybody else do is posit forces built around non-crewed automated platforms, autonomous platforms that have to be supervised, that have to have some human in the loop to control them and how they're employed, but you no longer necessarily occupy the fighting platform itself. And I try to set up structures in each case. So in the general cases, there's a hierarchy, an echelonment that happens as we have in current forces. And at the first two or three echelons, maybe you don't have people. You have machines, and those machines are controlled at a higher echelon. So if you take the operating model for the Army of, squads, platoons, companies, and battalions, you don't have people really until you get to something like the battalion or maybe even the brigade level. Now, this introduces some really interesting things that are very counter-traditional. Forces have always had to train as teams and train together to develop expertise, to develop capacity to operate together, and to develop teamwork and trust in each other. That all changes once you start replacing the people with machines to do some of those functions. You can plug and play machines in an organizational structure any way you want to. They don't need to have known the people they're working with. It's just another machine like themselves. So you can rehearse and plan and train and do things with enormous amount of flexibility. So the organizational structures that we know and love and are used to, you get to be completely rethought. You don't take all the people out by any means. There's still a lot of people involved in these forces, but their role changes. And the key role becomes executive supervision or battle management, command and control, as opposed to actually being the operator of a specific weapon system or platform. This is all very fundamental. And as you indicated, I think this is coming. I think others are going to figure it out first if we don't. The signs are all out there that that's happening. And I don't think we're thinking broadly enough and moving forward as quickly enough as we could be to figure out how to use these things most effectively to develop them and to put them in the hands of our operators.
You make a very important point, I think, in the book, that once you start taking the manning out of certain systems, and because you were Secretary of the Air Force, let's just stay with aircraft for a second, and you don't have to protect the pilot or co-pilot, and you don't have to worry about them being in the aircraft when it's executing its mission, that it opens up a lot of design space because you don't have to worry about how many G's they're pulling and that kind of thing. Could you just talk about that briefly, and then I'll kick it over to Elliot?
Yeah, it does in several ways. The thing needed to support human beings is a major design constraint on everything that we build. I mean, it doesn't matter what platform it is. You've got to keep the human in it alive, and you've got to restrict what that machine does to things that a human can tolerate. You're only going to get as much endurance as a human can handle. People have to sleep. They have to rest. They have to be fed. So a lot of requirements go away when there aren't any people on the platform. Another thing that opens up, very important tactically, is your willingness to intentionally expend some of those machines. We ask our military professionals to take a lot of risk right now, but we would not put them where we're certain they're going to be killed. But you can do that with these. You can sacrifice some of them, essentially, similar to a sacrifice move in chess, I guess, for the purpose of the greater performance of the larger enterprise, or the larger unit, if you will. That opens up a whole range of tactics that aren't really available to us today. One of the interesting experiences I had as I was going through this, which I implemented for the Air Force, some of the things in the book I had the opportunity to actually implement. One of them was the uncrewed collaborative combat aircraft, which essentially are uncrewed fighters that are controlled by a crewed fighter as a formation, basically, that he or she manages. And one of the things you can do there is put some of those platforms where they're at extreme risk and almost certain to be destroyed in order to force the enemy to expose himself, in order to get their weapons expended in a way which, even though their sacrifice, still is cost effective. But after we've been working on this for several months, and I'd made the decision and told the Air Force this is what we're going to do, I was briefed by some of our young fighter pilots who are working on the tactics for these things. And I took the opportunity to ask them, okay, I thought there'd be more resistance to this in the Air Force, because effectively I'm bringing in uncrewed fighters, and this is kind of what people have always done. And the answer I got was, sir, we understand that these things are going to keep us alive. And I thought that was really important, that they were, instead of resisting this, they were embracing it because they knew there was a need and they knew this was going to be an important contribution to their success. So that all applies as well, right? And so we're still a long way away from the sort of thing I have in the book. And one of the reasons I put it out was because I think we need to think much more creatively and broadly and transformatively about where the force is going. But, you know, our operators at least are open to some degree to this, and that's encouraging to me.
So it is a wonderful book, Frank. I think the chilling part of it is that the subtitle, Whether We Like It or Not, because I think one of the things that makes the book powerful is that there is this sense of urgency in it, that if we don't master this, we're going to be in big trouble. And I have to say, you know, when you read some of the stories out there, so for example, there was an exercise, I think, in Grafenwehr in Germany, where the United States, we deployed, I don't know whether it was a battalion or brigade, against a Ukrainian, fairly modern Ukrainian drone force, and we got clobbered. And, you know, you have much more experience with the U.S. military than I do, but what I read and what my experience tells me is that individual pieces of equipment, sure, people will happily adopt them, and they won't fight them. But the kind of large scale adaptation that you're talking about is much, much harder, and there tends to be much more resistance to it. Does that square with your experience? And then I've got a follow on question I'd like to ask after that.
It does, Elliot, and that result doesn't surprise me very much. The Ukrainians have had the most challenging training environment one can imagine for over 4 years now. The ones who have survived have figured out how to do that. They've adopted very quickly. I don't think it's necessary the model exactly for what we should do, but it's a very strong pointer in the right direction. And I think your point about the degree of change here, what I am suggesting to our senior operators is that what they have spent their entire lives mastering is about to be obsolete. That's a hard thing to accept. We have incredibly capable professionals who operate all of our different types of weapon systems in any of the services, you know, very proficiently, and they advance by being really good at that and training other people to be good at it. The idea that that might suddenly be replaced is it's like telling the cavalry at World War II, we're not going to have any more cavalry. It's very hard emotionally for people to accept that. And I say in the book several times that cultural resistance may be the biggest problem here. Whether we like it or not has several nuances about it. One is the idea that there's something inherently immoral or uncomfortable about autonomous killing machines, right? You know, a few years ago, about 100 very prominent people wrote a letter saying that we've got to ban these things. We need a treaty. That's not going to happen for a variety of reasons. And I lay them out in quite a bit of detail in the book. So whatever revulsion or, you know, however we might be repelled by this idea, I actually think it's better to have machines doing being consumed in than people. Wars are horrific. I start the book with the statement that I hate war, and I do. We need to find a better way to resolve our differences, obviously. Another is that this is going to happen. If the U.S. doesn't lead in this area, others will. And the original report the book is based on was written as a secret working paper because I didn't want China to read it. After five more years or six more years, China's figured this out. They're moving forward. If we didn't have a peer competitor, our current forces would be fine. But we do have a peer competitor. We could arguably say we have two, if you put Russia and China in that category. And others will adopt this, right? It applies a lot of commercial technologies and can be adopted relatively quickly by others. So we're going to be facing this threat. And as time goes on, it's going to get more and more sophisticated, more and more capable. We can't afford to be behind. One of the things I told people in the Air Force, in the Space Force, when I had the opportunity to point them in the right direction, I think, was that if I could do just one thing, accomplish one thing as secretary, it would be create a sense of urgency. We've got to get over our complacency about our superiority in the world and start recognizing that we do have a very capable, thoughtful, technologically sophisticated competitor now in China. And we better start taking that much more seriously than I think we have been.
Yeah. I mean, that's such an important message. But I guess here's there are two kickers that for me that follow from this. One is, it seems to me usually in the past, in circumstances like this, we were introducing new modes of warfare. You need new generals and admirals. You know, you need to find just a different cadre of people. And it's no criticism of their predecessors, but you know, it's why the airborne generals of World War II were in their 30s, as was Curtis LeMay. I mean, I wonder if that sort of thing is going to be necessary. Can our system even do that? I mean, you would need, I think, a fairly tough-minded and highly intelligent Secretary of Defense, which is not what we've got, to do something like that, to say the least. The second question that I have, though, that follows behind that one is, well, actually, maybe if you could address that one, and then let me ask one more question, and I'll throw it back to Eric.
I think up to a point, you're right. I give our people more credit than that. People are very adaptable. Once they recognize the need for the change and the magnitude of the change, I think people will respond. The first thing that they're going to do, and this is happening now, is they're going to look at these new technologies as ways to make the things that they're familiar with and understand better, as opposed to replacing them. And they've got to get past that mindset. But I think you're right. I think we need to emphasize technical excellence, science and engineering knowledge and expertise much more than I think we have been. During the Cold War, we were in a much better position on that. And I found this to be true, particularly when I went back and took the Air Force job on. We need to get over it. We need to recognize that brain power is much more important than biceps right now in terms of our success. And I think what the current Secretary of Defense is doing is the exact opposite of that direction. I can go on and on about that, but that's not what I'm here to talk about. There are people, I can tell you this from experience, there are plenty of smart, sophisticated, open-minded officers in our services, but they're not necessarily getting promoted to the senior positions. So I think we need to take some actions, take some reforms, if you will, that will identify and enhance and reward those people. I'm going to give you a quick war story. One of the things I did when I took over the Air Force was I put into promotion letters of instruction that the secretary puts out, that we value science and engineering expertise, that people have degrees in things like, take AI, for example, or cybersecurity or any of these things, automation, autonomy. We really need to be identifying and promoting those people. And that is a value to the Air Force. I put that into promotion letters of instruction. I realized several months later, as I was reading one, that some of our letters of instruction had a historic paragraph that said that advanced degrees will be masked from the promotion board. If you have an advanced degree, we're gonna black that out so that the promotion board doesn't know you have an advanced degree. And I said, what? And that was right after my paragraph about we value science and engineering. And I said, where did this come from? And it wasn't in the particular one that I had modified and looked at closely earlier. It came from a history of promotion boards using whether somebody had an advanced degree or not as a determining requirement to distinguish all the perfect records they were looking at. And so all of the fighter pilots in the Air Force and all the pilots in general all had to go out and get degrees because they figured out the boards were doing this and people went out and got all kinds of degrees and things like strategy and so on. And it really irritated the pilots. So they said, we're going to fix this problem. We're going to take this out of the thing. So you won't even know whether I've got an advanced degree or not. And my reaction is, you don't want a promotion board to know somebody has a PhD in AI from MIT or Caltech, my school. This is insane. But that's where it came from. And apparently this had gone back and forth two or three times in the Air Force. And I asked all of my four stars one day in a meeting we had, how they felt about me putting, removing that and exposing these degrees to the boards. And every one of them except one thought that they should not be a factor for promotions to major, lieutenant, colonel, and colonel. And I thought, wow, the one was my head of acquisition, the four star in charge of acquisition. Anyway, I think we definitely need to change the mindset about this. And we need to start valuing this kind of expertise. We absolutely have to have qualified people to help us write better requirements and interact more effectively with industry. There's no question about it.
Actually, that just that anecdote, Frank, I think it really shows the power of a really good civilian secretary, service secretary, because they can shape promotion by those letters of instruction. So it's a great example of why that those are very important roles to play. The last question I want to ask before throwing it back to Eric is this. It's a great book, very thoughtful, very thought-provoking, makes perfect sense to me. What troubles me is it would seem to me this is the kind of thing that the really smart lieutenant colonels and colonels, commanders and captains should be writing about. And again, I'll fall back on history being one of those people whose advanced degree doesn't have anything to do with counting, beyond elementary arithmetic. When you look at Air Land Battle, for example, that came out of a very interesting military culture in the Army. There's people like Don Starry, Paul Gorman, Huba Vastashega. There's a whole cluster of them, very successful operators, Vietnam veterans, who are really thinking about the nature of their profession, really thinking about the nature of future war, really thinking about how do we take these new technologies. Not only did they come up with airline battle, they also came up with new institutions like the School of Advanced Military Studies. What's troubling here is not the book, which is great, but why are you the guy writing it rather than a whole bunch of people in uniform? And my fear, again, just from what I see with military officers is they're not really encouraged to do that kind of thing, unfortunately.
I'm afraid you're right, up to a point. I had people that I interacted with as secretary, some fairly senior, who I think were open-minded, creative, and innovative, and others who were much less so. I do think it's worth examining our promotion system in particular, to look at whether we're promoting sort of cookie cutter backgrounds that all look the same and conform to a certain norm, cultural norm, if you will. I'm afraid we are. And I'm very distant from my Army experience. That was a long time ago. The Air Force experience is much more current. Same is true of the Space Force. Space Force, because it's so tiny and so technical, I think is a little different situation. It's unique. But the Air Force, and I would expect that the Navy and the Army are both in the same boat, and probably the Marine Corps to a degree. People are very good at aligning themselves with what they think will help them advance. And I think that, that's troubling. And I think it does take civilian leadership maybe to prod people in the right direction. But one of the things you do as civilian leaders, you pick the senior general officers. All of our 3- and 4-star positions are handpicked by service secretaries with the help of the service chiefs, and then go through the Secretary of Defense and the president. So one of the more important things that you can do in those roles of leadership is try to bring along people that have the kind of capabilities you just described. And I think we need to do that. You know, step one is recognizing, and as I know Don's story very well. I knew some of the people responsible for some of those earlier doctrine developments. They took the emerging technologies, or they reacted to what the threat was doing. I mean, the case of the air-land battle and even the follow-on forces attack, assault breaker things that were the next thing after that. The Soviet threat was a compelling threat. It was massive, and trying to defeat it with traditional means wasn't going to work. So that operational imperative, phrase I used a lot when I was secretary, drove those people to try to find new ways of doing business, because there was a general recognition that what we had wasn't going to be good enough. All of our senior military leaders today have never experienced a world in which the U.S. was seriously challenged by a peer competitor. I mean, I spent 20 years as a Cold Warrior. I know what that's like. I was running tactical warfare programs development for the DOD during the last few years of the Cold War. That focuses the mind very well, knowing that you have a serious adversary that you've got to do something about. I think there was an increasing recognition of that, and I did everything I could to move that along. But there's still almost a knee-jerk presumption deeply embedded in people that we're the best by a lot and that we don't have to worry about anybody else. It's a complacency and a sense of almost an American entitlement to military dominance, which is no longer valid. China has spent 20 or more years building a military designed to defeat the United States if we project power in the Western Pacific. Their military is focused entirely on achieving that objective. They've had a lot of resources. They've thought about it carefully. And we really have got to respond with a greater sense of urgency.
Completely agree.
Yeah, I do too. Frank, I mean, the book is terrific. I commend it to our listeners and viewers. I do want to move on and get your reaction to a couple of other issues. I mean, you've actually been in the news, not just for the book this past week. And just briefly, let me say that you were asked by a couple of news outlets to comment on the president having taken the Qatari jet that was gifted to him to become an interim Air Force One. To the NATO summit. We've had all these stories about the threat that existed against the plane. You made some pretty elementary observations that in the time span and with the amount of money spent, they couldn't possibly have actually outfitted the aircraft with the suite of capabilities that we normally put on Air Force One to protect the president. It's one of the most important things we can do for special air missions when the president is traveling. And as a result of making those pretty, you know, seem to me vanilla observations, the Department of Defense has pulled your security clearance, arguing that you've revealed classified information. What can you tell us about that?
Sure. Well, first of all, I've been pretty vocal about this, Eric. I've had a security clearance for 60 years. I know what's classified and what isn't. And I've never said anything classified to the press. I've been very careful about that and push back on their many attempts to try to get me to say more than I would. I was quoted in an article in the New York Times, which also talked about some, quote, leakers who had made some comments about the new airplane. I was not one of those leakers. I don't know anything about what's on that airplane. It was acquired after I left office. I did write an op-ed about why the president should not be accepting an airplane from a foreign state and using it as Air Force One. And I've been very openly critical of this administration and my concerns about it ever since I left office. So I'm sort of an enemy of the people, I guess, from the point of view of this administration. And I'm sort of a convenient scalp to hang up if you have to get somebody in reaction to what that article and those leakers. Apparently, they couldn't find the leakers. They tried to subpoena the reporters, and that hasn't worked. And I think they just needed to do something. So there I was, right? I've hired an attorney, Mark Zaid, who's also been had the same problem. His security clearance was pulled without justification. And he's representing several of the over 100 people that this has happened to. So it's one of the tools that this administration uses, one of the abuses of power that they among very many that they use to try to coerce people to do what they want and to intimidate others into, you know, keeping their mouth shut and not speaking up. I'm not going to do that. There's too much at stake here. What happens to me is of no particular consequence. Whether the rule of law and our democracy survive is of enormous consequence. And I'm going to do whatever I can to try to make sure that that happens.
Well said. Yeah. Totally agree.
Well, Frank, we're the country's very lucky to have you in more ways than one.
Thanks, Elliot. Same is true of both of you gentlemen. So it's great to be here with you.
Let me before we let you go, two quick things. They're very much on people's minds. One is the current state of the war with Iran. I mean, the president seemed to think that overwhelming application of air power could very quickly lead to the collapse of the Iranian regime. That obviously hasn't happened. He still is holding out, at least theoretically, the option of having an additional massive attack. What's your interim judgment, since we can only all have interim judgments, since this is still a conflict in media res, of where this is? What does it say about limitations of the use of air power for different military purposes, in your view?
Eric, it's been a strategic blunder of massive proportions, and we could go on and on about the implications for the Persian Gulf, for the Middle East, for our relationships with others around the world. Let me stick to, you know, Iran and immediate consequences. The air power is inherently limited. It's a great tool. It has a lot of capability. It can be decisive in a conflict and often is. Right? But by itself, it's very hard to achieve political aims, diplomatic aims, if you will, with just air power. The only case I can think of where that was done was in Serbia. And what happened there was that the elite around Milosevic at the time weren't going to have their economy and their personal wealth destroyed by our aircraft, and they got him out of power. We're not seeing that happening in Iran. We have it hardened the resistance there, if anything. We have not destroyed their ability to control the strait, and we certainly haven't done anything to destroy their nuclear ambitions or limit their nuclear program at this point. So I don't see a good way out of this. I think the president walked into a trap that no other president has walked into. And it's a net loss no matter where we go from here. Air power is not going to get you out of this. I mean, you could, if you want to invade Iran and take over the country and live with the consequences of that, you could get a different outcome. I don't think anybody's up for that. So we're in a situation where, frankly, it's in Iran's interest to kind of deal with this. They've kind of accomplished their strategic objectives, as far as I can tell. Additional air attacks are probably not going to change that equation. You know, we can speculate about why Trump is, at the moment at least, restraining himself from doing that and talking about economic sanctions. We need to get this over with. We need to get the straits open. I think that's the highest priority right now. Then we need to work to try to further limit Iran's nuclear program. But some of you are better positioned than I am talking about the foreign relations implications of this. But it's a lesson we shouldn't have had to learn again. Air power alone, while it's effective at a lot of things, is not by itself necessarily going to achieve a political objective. And here we are.
Yeah. By the way, I thought this past week there was one small item which also speaks to your book. It was about how that American F-15 got shot down. And at least as I think this is the Institute for the Study of War reporting it, it was essentially an ambush by a dozen or so Iranian drones in a fairly sophisticated attack using, you know, unmanned, uncrewed vehicles. So it I think it does speak also to that aspect of what we've been discussing as well.
Yeah, don't know, Ellie, if that's true or not, but it's an example of how you can do very creative things with unmanned systems. There's another thing related to that F-15, and we have used an enormous number of standoff weapons, very expensive, smart standoff weapons. And I've asked a number of people, why is that the case? The targets we're going after could generally be attacked with JDAMs, you know, relatively, you know, inexpensive munitions, but they're short range munitions. One of the speculations I have heard, and I don't know if it's true or not, is that we're very concerned about somebody being shot down and captured. We went to enormous lengths to extract that airman that was shot down. I think politically, to have an American airman on TV in the hands of the Iranians right now would be devastating politically. And that may be, it's speculation, but that may be one of the reasons we've relied so much on much more expensive standoff munitions as much as we have, which has put us in apparently a very difficult situation in other theaters and for other possible contingencies.
Maybe that's a good final question to end on, Frank, which is a lot of discussion about drawdown of particularly the high-end munitions, both air-to-air, air-to-ground, Tomahawks, and of course, air and missile defense interceptors, most of all. Can you just briefly, I think a lot of people are sort of mystified by why it is that, you know, we've got this this problem of having, you know, run down our munitions stocks, and why it is that it seems to be so hard, and likely, according to Elliot's colleagues at CSI, it's going to be a couple of 3 years before we can actually get back to the, you know, status quo ante antebellum in this instance. Can you just explain that? I think it's very hard for our, you know, normal sure. viewers and listeners to understand that.
Just several factors come together here. One is that we have designed our systems. I'm going to use Patriot as an example. You can say the same about some of the offensive standoff systems. It's are designed to work against the more sophisticated threats. The pacing threats for something like Patriot, for example, is a long-range ballistic missile, possibly one with some maneuvering capability, possibly one with some ability to, you know, accompanied by decoys or something. And those have been the pacing threats that we designed against. Up until relatively recently, we haven't had to worry about really cheap, kind of off-the-shelf unmanned systems that are essentially low-cost cruise missiles, right? They're one-way UAVs. That wasn't the threat that we were worried about. It didn't exist. So we didn't design for it. So the absence of something that's much cheaper that would not be effective against the threats we have worried about is explained by that. The length of time it takes to get more of these products is also explained by the fact that they're very complicated, sophisticated designs, which embed a lot of components that it takes a long time to build. You don't just have a production line where you stamp these things out. You've got a supply chain with seekers and warheads and rocket motors and so on in it, and control systems that all has to be brought together and then assembled and then provided. And the lead time, you know, traditionally for the more sophisticated missiles is on the order of 18 months. The lead time to increase production capacity, which was already maxed out for some of these, is a couple of years to build all the tooling and build the factory, basically. So you don't recover from this quickly. And what's happening now, and this started when I was Secretary of the Air Force, actually, is designing for the offensive weapon side, at least, low-cost cruise missiles that where you're going to not worry as much about penetrating very sophisticated air defenses. You're going to just be able to have a lot of things to throw at the targets. The similar thing is being done on the air defense side of the house, is to build less expensive, less sophisticated systems that are much cheaper to intercept these fairly primitive by weapon systems definition anyway, unmanned systems that are coming in as cruise missiles effectively. So there's a reaction time associated, right, with this. And there's also this is a new threat. Should it have been foreseen? Possibly. We had a similar situation with IEDs. You know, nobody realized that IEDs were going to be a massive problem, the defining problem, basically, when we went into Iraq and then in Afghanistan. So we had to react to that. The world changes. New threats emerge. You can't anticipate everything and be ready for everything ahead of time. you do your best. But as I think Don Rumsfeld famously said, you enter a war with the things you already have, not the things you wish you had or that you'd like to get. So.
Indeed. Indeed. Our guest has been Frank Kendall, former Secretary of the Air Force, former Undersecretary of Defense for Acquisition. He's the author of Lethal Autonomy, the Future of Warfare. And Frank, it's been a pleasure having you this afternoon. Thanks so much for joining us.
Great to be on. Good to see both of you here, Ellie.